Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we get into our show, we're hoping you can give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show, and now it can help you win a signed copy of my book, John Turner, An Intimate Biography of Canada's 17th Prime Minister. Let us know that you've left a rating or review by sending us a screenshot of it at onpolitics@tvo.org, and you'll be entered in our giveaway. We'll announce the winner at the end of June. Best of luck. Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly Podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the Ontario Place new science centre deal is evolving yet again.
The province has a new incentive to get more people to become police officers.
The Minister of Transportation has taken the gag order off the head of Metrolinx, so we actually have some new information about the billions in transit projects currently underway in Ontario.
And another new feature, your column, my column. Stick around and find out what that one's all about. It's Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023, so let's get to it.
Hey, partner, I guess we should start this podcast by saying that I am on the road for a few days here, so I am in an undisclosed location, a very secretive bunker somewhere on the North American continent, and you are, by the looks of it, in a very place similar to what looks like home, but I'm not saying.
Yeah, I continue to represent the East York Bureau here at TVO.
Okay, very good. Now, you mentioned that today's date is May the 2nd. And I wonder, does the expression, the realities of May the 2nd, mean anything to you?
It does not. It's aside from not being May the 4th, no, I have no context to know what that means.
Well, May the 4th, we all understand, is Star Wars Day, as in May the 4th be with you. But May the 2nd is a different thing, and the realities of May the 2nd is a different thing. So humor me, if you would, as I take us down memory lane here. Because 38 years ago on this day, this became one of the most frequently used expressions at Queen's Park. And the reason is payback is a word that rhymes with rich. Now, here's the story. From 1975 to 1981, former Premier Bill Davis sat atop a bunch of minority governments, two minority governments. But in 1981, on March the 19th, 1981, he reclaimed his majority. And he was very happy about that. And whenever the opposition went hard after the Davis government, the premier would always say in the legislature, "We thank you for your advice, but given the realities of March 19th, we're going to do it our way." And the realities of March 19th was code for, "We've got a majority now, it's no longer a minority parliament, and we really don't need to indulge you anymore." Okay. Fast forward 4 years. Mr. Davis has retired. Frank Miller has taken over as premier. He calls an election for, wait for it, May the 2nd, 1985, and it might have been just the most exciting election in Ontario history. The Progressive Conservatives didn't win the most seats, 52, but the Liberals were close behind with 48, and the Liberals actually got more votes. So it's a minority parliament, and the NDP leader, Bob Rae, has the balance of power and is going to be the kingmaker. And he decides, after negotiations with both the PCs and the Liberals, that he's going to back David Peterson and the Liberals, in a way very similar to what Jagmeet Singh is doing for Prime Minister Trudeau today. Peterson becomes Ontario's 20th premier. Now, where am I going with all this? Here's where. Whenever the Tories got up in the House, they're in opposition now, remember, to ask a question about how awful the Liberals were, David Peterson would respond with, "Mr. Speaker, given the realities of May the 2nd, we're going to do it our way and you guys can just sit down and thank you very much." So, under the category that turnabout is fair play and payback is a word that rhymes with rich, the realities of May 2nd became a very popular expression in the Queen's Park lexicon. And yes, believe it or not, all of that came into my head when you mentioned that today is May the 2nd. So there you go. What do you think of all that?
One thing I think about whenever the 1985 election comes up in conversation, which comes up more than probably most people would expect. One of the things that's, I think, really important about that decade that, you know, in some ways is overlooked relative to like what came after with the Harris and McGuinty governments. By 1995, there were almost no MPPs left who had been MPPs before 1985. There was such a huge turnover in the legislature. A whole bunch of institutional memory effectively disappeared. That, I think, in part explains why things got so nasty and combative, especially between like the Ray governments and the Harris governments, because a whole era of, let's say, more, I don't know, laid back politics, that whole era of politicians, in many cases, they were simply out of a job now. That's what occurs to me when I hear about 1985. I read a really interesting paper several years ago where they did interviews with MPPs who served during that time. And one of the things that they talked about was like, yes, the Harris government was acrimonious and sometimes deliberately so, but also it was just like there had been such a sea change in politics. As I say, I think some people still don't appreciate it.
That's a great observation. And I would have one last observation on this. And that is, I covered that 1985 election with your father. And now I am discussing it with his son. If that's not another indication that time marches on, oh dear,
TikTok. It's relentless, TikTok. Man.
Well, just a reminder, dear listener, we love hearing from you at the email address onpolitics@tvo.org. And JMM, why don't you stick your hand into the virtual mailbag there and tell us what we've got this week.
We have a question from listener Ian, who writes, big fan of the podcast. I have a probably fairly odd question that is very hypothetical, hopefully. What would happen if no candidates gets any vote in an election? I assume this would occur due to bad weather or a small municipal election. Who would win the seat, or would a by-election just be called? Hope you can answer this question.
That's intriguing.
It is. It is. And before I get into this answer, I want to start by thanking the media team at Elections Ontario, because we turned this around pretty quickly and they were extremely forgiving for a tight deadline here. You could imagine this explicit scenario isn't exactly spelled out in legislation, but it turns out it's actually not that opaque, because what we are effectively talking about here is a tie vote. It's a weird kind of tie vote, but it is a tie all the same, right? Zero votes for any candidate. That's a tie. And there's a procedure in the Elections Act for how to deal with close elections. If the official results of an election show fewer than 25 votes between the first and second place candidate, there is an automatic mandatory recount. There's a whole process for that that I won't get into here, but for our purposes, the important bit of the Elections Act is section 77.2, and you knew I would have the section number for you.
Hang on, I'm writing that down. Section 77.2, because I want to go consult it right after we're done here. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, keep going.
And it says that after a recount has been overseen by a judge, if there is still, quote, an equality of votes, then the returning officer for the riding shall give the casting vote and break the tie. I want to emphasize that is not optional. The law requires that the returning officer cast a ballot, so you can't have them try to perpetuate the tie somehow. And in the hypothetical we are describing above, that would mean they cast the only vote to elect an MPP. Now, there have been some tight elections in Ontario history, but I doubt we have ever had an MPP elected with a single valid ballot, certainly not in the modern era.
I think we have achieved new heights of nerddom on that one. That's a great story. Okay.
And yet, very cool. I promise we will keep reaching. We will keep reaching ever higher for the new peak of nerddom.
I have no doubt about it. Once again, everybody, if you'd like to ask about the content on the program or ask any questions as well, please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org. And now on to issue one. JMM, I know we have talked about this Ontario Place, Ontario Science Centre story a lot lately, but the story keeps evolving. Last week, we told you that the provincial government had a plan to demolish the current Science Centre building in Midtown Toronto, replace it with housing, then build a new Science Centre at a reimagined Ontario Place, which would include a giant spa owned and operated by the Austrian company Terme. Reaction to that plan has been, well, let's call it mixed, to say the least. Some people want the old Science Centre building preserved. Others have observed that it sits in a ravine, where replacing it with thousands of units of housing may be tougher than you think. Still others have expressed concern that the new Science Centre won't be as big as the old one. There's also the notion that, despite the Premier's insistence, the taxpayers won't be on the hook for any of this. The plans do call for the province to build, for Terme, a $300 to $600 million underground parking garage. And now there's more talk about how we're going to get a subway or maybe subway users from Exhibition Place via the new Ontario Line to Ontario Place? Do we need a cable car? Do we need shuttle buses or even something else? Anyway, for a plan that I'm sure the province thought was well thought through, it seems there are still quite a few loose ends.
Yes, and just as you go down that litany of loose ends, I mean, I'm struck by how many of these issues are really obvious and have been well known for years. I mean, just the idea of how do you get passengers from Exhibition Place to Ontario Place? It's not like a huge distance to cover, but anybody who's walked those windswept parking lots in the winter knows that that's not a fun walk. And, you know, if you're trying to make this a year-round attraction, that, you know, that's a difficult thing for pedestrians to do. This is, of course, all about community consultation. Local residents, both along the waterfront and around the current site of the Science Center, do not think they have been adequately consulted about these plans. The union that represents employees at the current Science Center has come out against the plan. That's the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, OPSU, one of the larger unions in the public service. You know, they like the Science Center where it is. This issue of what the union thinks is relevant specifically because Premier Ford said the workers at the Science Center would enjoy a new facility and the easier commute with the Ontario Line subway. The subway, of course, does not currently exist. So small matter there. There is also the fine print in the current Science Center lease, which says if the existing facility is torn down, they have to replace it with another Science Center at the same location. I did not know about that particular finer point in the lease. That was interesting. You know, we wrote about this in last week's On Poly newsletter. The notion that this government makes some pretty high-profile, big-ticket announcements without necessarily having all of the details ironed out.
Well, let's do some ironing ourselves, you and I, right now. Let's go through some of these ideas here. The Premier says taxpayers won't be on the hook for any of this, but he also says the province has agreed to pay $300 to $600 million for a new parking garage for Terme. Now, how can both of those statements be true?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that they're really not. If I were going to make the charitable argument for the government, I guess what I would say is that whatever is at Ontario Place, this is likely to be a valuable public piece of land, whether Therme ever opens a spa there or whether some other public amenity is there. There are similar parking lots in other parts of the waterfront around Toronto, down by Harbourfront Center, that kind of thing. So if they do go ahead and build this parking garage, it will get some use, even if it's not specifically a taxpayer benefit to the proposed spa.
Okay, let's check in and see how significant the union's opposition is. I mean, of course, everyone would love to have a job with guarantees that the proprietor will never move to another city or another part of the city. So I ask the question, is the union entitled to a veto on this project?
Formally, no. No more than the union that represented Ontario Place workers back in the day had any say in whether the McGuinty government could shut down Ontario Place. They made their opinions known quite forcefully. They spoke to reporters about why they thought the decision by the McGuinty government was incorrect. But at the end of the day, when the provincial government made the decision to shut down Ontario Place, the union really didn't have much recourse.
All right, let's do a follow on that. Is the union entitled to the expectation that their jobs should exist at the corner of Don Mills Road and Eglinton Avenue East for time immemorial?
No, and for the same reasons as we are discussing here. I'm going to take a different example. When the Wynne government wound down parts of Ontario Northland, the union there warned that the government was not fully accounting for all of the costs and benefits of that decision. They made their argument in public. The Wynne government went ahead with it anyway. Ontario Northland still persists in a reduced form. But, you know, it's the same basic argument that, the union gets to make its representation to the public, to the government, but the government's decision really is, well, I should say the legislature's decision really is final.
Let's keep going. Couldn't the province, if push comes to shove, just say these are provincial institutions we're talking about, and if we want to do this, we'll simply pass a law and make it happen?
Right. And I hinted at this just earlier there when I said that, you know, the legislature really does have the final decision. So let's talk about the idea of the fact that you can't build housing in the ravine. Well, this is land that is currently regulated by the Toronto Region Conservation Authority. That is a creature of provincial statute. The city of Toronto is also similarly a creature of provincial statute. The legislature of Ontario can void leases. You know, contracts are the kind of thing that the province can change with legislation if it needs to. So at the end of the day, the legislature really does have enormous power to change all of these conditions if it wants to. Now, obviously, I think it's better just from a democratic point of view to negotiate an agreement, get, you know, everybody sort of on the same side, like an agreement that everybody can live with, if not enthusiastically support. You know, all of this is supposed to start happening by 2025, the year before the next provincial and municipal election. The last thing the province needs is to be stuck having a huge fight with its own capital city, where, let's just remind people, you know, the Ford Progressive Conservatives currently hold a large number of seats. They want to retain those. Certainly, if they have to lose them, they want to minimize their losses. You know, people, I think, sometimes want to pretend this isn't true, but Doug Ford is a Toronto MPP. He gets elected from the riding of Etobicoke North, and he seems to, and we'll say with some notable exceptions, he does seem to prefer to get along with as many municipal politicians as possible.
Well, I've got a feeling this story isn't over yet and may continue to evolve, so we, of course, shall keep our eye on it. And in the meantime, we're on to issue two.
We're pleased to announce new measures to address policing shortages to get more boots on the ground in every part of the province, including right here in Toronto. To help police services attract new recruits, our government will now cover 100% of the cost of tuition.
That's Premier Doug Ford announcing that anyone who wants to be a police officer can now do so tuition free. Okay, John Michael, what's the thinking here?
Crime is a very visible problem in the city of Toronto and elsewhere right now. Whether the rate of violent crime is greater than in prior years is, we're just not going to hash that out right now. But certainly there have been a series of very public, very visible incidents, and it's become pretty salient in the mayoral election that is happening in the city of Toronto right now. And the province also has its role to respond to this. So, you know, we are seeing the premier respond in part to things like some violent incidents on the TTC. Obviously, also, I don't think I have to tell our listeners that law and order crime issues, these are sort of the bread and butter for conservative political parties, this provincial government certainly no less than any other.
That's not all that the Ford Conservatives have up their sleeve on this one. The government isn't just making police academy tuition free. They are also removing a requirement that police officers have a university degree. David Moskrop wrote a piece about this on the TVO website, tvo.org. He does not like this idea. Check out his piece. The optics of this change are curious. With all the coverage we've seen on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border of police misconduct, you could argue lowering the standard for police recruitment has obviously raised some eyebrows. So tell us about that.
The interesting thing, one of the interesting things about this is that, strictly speaking, the government isn't lowering the standard, or at least the announced policy does not materially change who was and was not going to actually be qualified to be a police officer in Ontario.
Okay. David Moskrop disagrees with that view. So explain away, please. What do you mean?
Right. So this goes back to before Doug Ford became premier. In 2017, Justice Michael Tulloch issued a report to the Liberal government of the day outlining a number of suggested reforms to police oversight and training in Ontario. Tulloch, by the way, is now the Chief Justice of Ontario and head of the Court of Appeal. In 2018, the Liberal government passed its big police reform bill, which included this new requirement that new police officers would have to have a university degree. You wouldn't get fired as a police officer for not having a university degree, but new police recruits would have to have a university degree. But then guess what happened?
Well, I know we did have an election in there.
Correct. And so the Ford government repealed the liberal police bill and reintroduced one of their own. But because this is never simple, they actually kept the requirement for university degrees, and that became law in early 2019.
So accurate to say, since 2019, police officers have had to have university degrees?
No, of course not. Actually, the government never proclaimed that section of their own law, and it has been sitting in legislative limbo ever since the lieutenant governor signed it 4 years ago. So the Tories inherited something from previous government, repealed it, re-legislated it, never actually implemented it, and are now repealing their own requirement.
Please explain how that makes sense.
Honestly, I mean, I can explain what happened here, but I'm not sure I could tell you why any of this happened. I mean, if I were going to guess, you could make the argument that even just having the requirement on the books, even if it wasn't in force, would have affected who thought that they could apply, and maybe it was suppressing recruitment. But this is just a weird one.
In which case, we're on to issue three.
We want this project completed, but I gotta say, my biggest concern is that the quality is right and that we get a safe transit system. We're building infrastructure here for the next 100, 150 years, and we gotta get it right.
That was Metrolinx President and CEO Phil Verster at an event last week where he took some questions on recent developments with the Eglinton Crosstown project in Toronto. In a nutshell, the project has faced delay after delay after delay. One station is even being torn up due to uneven concrete, and it's coming in way over budget.
About $1 billion out of budget. the old joke, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. Well, and I want to add, strange to see Metrolinx coming out of the stealth mode that they've been operating in. There's been some coverage from a variety of news sources, but particularly I want to say the Toronto Star has been on this issue that Metrolinx has actually wanted to say more to the public than they have been allowed to by the provincial government. You know, nice to see Verster out there to help contextualize some of the delays, though he did so largely by throwing Crosslinx Transit, the private consortium that is building the transit line, he threw them under the bus or under the subway or LRT, pick your metaphor. Metrolinx explained that the extra work wouldn't come at any cost to the taxpayer and that they are actually withholding money from Crosslinx Transit Solutions until the project gets done.
So we're clearly going to have to wait a lot longer to see this project completed, but no one is yet in a position to say how much longer, right?
That is correct. Crosslinx still has to do certifications on their work and ensure quality control on everything. Verster's really got into the details of the quality assurance inspections that they are doing. If the rails are even a millimeter off in terms of width, it could cause the LRT car to ride up on them and derail. Here's a clip again of Verster's talking a bit about the many intricate moving parts of a project like this.
80 to 90% of megatransit projects across the world typically experience schedule or budget issues. And the reason for that is it's not a proud strategy, it's not an excuse either. It's just a reflection of the complexity that's often hidden in how these transit projects are delivered.
Well, he's not wrong. I mean, these are incredibly complicated projects and there are always surprises along the way. And not to make too big a poke at the capital city of the country here, but we've seen what happens when you don't dot your I's and cross your T's properly, and then you try to unveil an LRT that can't run in the wintertime or something. So let's just clarify who's responsible for what here, though, because there are two different entities involved in this project. Metrolinx is the government agency that signs the contracts and is supposed to keep on top of things to ensure that deadlines are met and targets are hit. But as you point out, there is this private sector consortium of construction companies called Crosslinx Transit, and they are the ones that are actually building this thing. Governments don't build. They hire companies which have the expertise to build. And this consortium of construction companies seems to be having a devil of a time trying to stay on time and on budget.
Yes, and it's also, I guess, worth giving our listeners some context that Metrolinx and Crosslinx have actually been hashing out some of this stuff in court. It's been, acrimonious at times. It's also gotten wrapped up in stuff about the pandemic when, there was certainly in early 2020 when there was a province-wide lockdown issued. Crosslinx was is appealing some of the effects of that. When the crosstown is in fact complete, it will not be operated by a private company. It will be operated by the TTC, Toronto's local transit service. It will not be operated by Metrolinx or GO. But the TTC can't start training their workers on the actual vehicles that will run on these tracks until the tracks are certified as safe to use. It's just a real mess of a situation. Verso has also said they are learning from other projects around the world. One imagines they are also applying some of the lessons you mentioned from Ottawa. In fact, the premier specifically cited the Ottawa LRT as something he does not want to repeat in Toronto. Verstors is frustrated as anyone that the problems are gumming up the works and that an LRT that was supposed to open, well, frankly, by now, will not open in 2023, it seems. We will get some sense of when in 2024, optimistically, it will open.
Okay, let's introduce you to a new feature we're rolling out on the On Poly podcast, and we're calling it Your Column, My Column. And it's really just a reminder that both of us, John Michael and yours truly, also write about provincial affairs on TVO's website, which is tvo.org. And this gives us a chance to follow up a bit on things that we wrote over the past week. And let's get started. For example, JMM, in one of your columns, you talked about how we could potentially generate a huge amount of electricity building more wind turbines, specifically in the Great Lakes. Okay, make that argument if you would.
This is an old hobby horse of mine. It's a disease among columnists. We have certain topics that we just obsess over. Basically, the offshore wind power industry is growing extremely rapidly, both in sophistication and in the literal size of turbines. They are now 10 times larger than they were 15 years ago. Despite that fact, and the fact that 90% of Ontario's residents live a relatively short distance from three of the Great Lakes, and we know there's potential there, the province is doing basically nothing on this topic. The reason we are doing nothing is one of the real black marks on the record of the last Liberal government, since despite the supports they gave to renewable energy for much of their time in power, they repeatedly sabotaged offshore wind projects that were proposed close to Liberal-held ridings, and that sabotage did rack up a substantial costs for Ontario taxpayers.
Well, the nuclear industry has always maintained that wind has three problems. Number one, you can't promise it's always going to be there. Number two, you can generate wind power for electricity, but you can't store it. And number three, it's not reliable enough to create what they call base load power. In other words, a foundation of reliable, affordable electricity that'll always be there come hell or high water or no wind. So you looked into this. How accurate is all of that now?
Well, the immediate prompt for my column last week was a report from the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, more or less bemoaning the state of wind power in Ontario. The Clean Air Alliance argued that we can replace the need for nuclear entirely with the combination of wind and also hydro imports from Quebec. Now, I think that's pretty optimistic, and not just for technical reasons. Like, I don't actually think there's a lot of appetite in Ontario for imported hydroelectricity from Quebec. The good news about building wind offshore, particularly farther offshore, is that winds tend to be both stronger and more reliable. And the revolution we have seen in batteries, for example, does mean that storing power is cheaper than it has ever been, and it is getting cheaper all the time. Now, that said, we probably still can't replace nuclear entirely, but I mean, that's a non-starter anyway. We are currently rebuilding Ontario's nuclear reactors. They are going to continue to function for decades to come. The idea of replacing those or even throwing away tens of billions of dollars of investment that are already underway, it's just not really up for discussion. But we could still potentially save some money, because it's not like we have all of the electricity we are ever going to need right now, especially if we want to electrify cars and heating home and offices. That's going to require a lot more electricity. That electricity is going to have to come from somewhere. It could very well be nuclear. The current government very enthusiastic on new nuclear builds. But the independent electricity system operator, which is responsible for doing the sort of long-term power planning in the province, does say that offshore wind would cost a fraction of what new nuclear is going to cost.
Hmm.
So that is my column. Now I'm going to ask you about your column last week, which was an obituary for one of the most influential champions of public education this province has ever seen.
Yes, indeed. Charles Pascal, who died last week at the age of 79, he went into hospital for some surgery. Complications ensued, and he died in hospital. I started off my column by saying it's a good thing Charles Pascal was not good enough to play in the major leagues of baseball, because had that been the case, we never would have known about him here. He was from Chicago originally. He played baseball at the University of Michigan. He was a catcher there. But thankfully for us, he did not have the talent to play in the majors. And so when he came to Canada, first to go to McGill, if you can imagine this, as an assistant professor at age 27, then becoming a full professor at 32, becoming a college president at the age of 37. My goodness, this guy really, he did have good game. He knew a lot about baseball, but thankfully, because he wasn't good enough to play in the majors, he dedicated his life to improving the education system in the province of Ontario. And you may know his name because his most significant contribution was as what they called the early childhood education czar for former Premier Dalton McGuinty. And it was his lobbying and his research and his efforts and his roadmap which eventually led that government to create what we call today in the province of Ontario, full-day kindergarten, which is one of the most popular programs the McGuinty government ever brought in.
That was his, I think, most public role, but he was also very influential behind the scenes too, right?
Very much so. If you go back further, go back 30 years, in the 1990s, he was the Deputy Minister of Education when the Ray government was in power in Ontario, a very influential guy there. He was executive director for a decade and a half of the Atkinson Foundation, a group that conducts a lot of research. So a lot of the funding that he put into research for things like education, the results would then come back and he would use that information again to press governments to, in his view, do the right thing. And then he became a professor right up until the end at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, OISE. And John Michael, unlike pretty much any other deputy minister I've ever encountered over my years, Charles Pascal was not one to just leave that job and disappear quietly, as most of them do. He was still a force. He was all over Twitter, giving it to anybody who in his view needed it because they weren't doing education policy the way it ought to be done. And just ask the current education minister, Stephen Lecce, about that. Dr. Pascal was all over Twitter. I think the expression is carving him a new one from time to time on how, in his view, this government was just letting the kids down with his education policy. He believed what a pretty good former education minister named Bill Davis believed, which was, if you get education right, everything else falls into place, right? If people are better educated, they get better jobs, they make more money, they pay more taxes so we can have more programs, they stay out of the hospital, they stay out of prison, they stay off welfare, but it all starts with education. And I guess I would just conclude by saying there will be a special public service to remember Charles Pascal. It's actually today. It's later today, Tuesday, May 2nd, 4 p.m. at OISE, the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at U of T, Bloor Street West in downtown Toronto. The public is invited to attend, and we take this moment to remember a really influential public servant and a great guy, a difficult guy sometimes, but a great guy, Charles Pascal.
And that is this week's edition of Your Column, My Column. Let us know if you want to get more of these listeners. We'll see if we turn this into a regular feature. Any feedback you have, we are happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org. Here's an email from listener Ashley, who writes, I grew up spending my summers in Tiny Township, and I still spend a week there every year with my children. The area was populated for thousands of years by the Huron-Wendat before European contact. I was not aware of the origin of the names until a few years ago, and I've always thought it uncomfortable that the area is now named after the little dogs of the wife of a lieutenant governor of Upper Canada. I think we could all do a better job of noticing and commenting on things like this when discussing the origins of place names or streets in Ontario. It makes the land and its history seem very trivial that 200 years ago, white Europeans felt it appropriate to name the area after a European aristocrat's pets.
Thank you indeed, Ashley. That's a great point, and I thank you for making it. And we should just say, that if you missed last week's podcast, this is a reference to a discussion we were having about some of the counties and regions around Ontario and the fact that, yes, indeed, some of those counties got named after the pets of the former lieutenant governor. So, Ashley, thank you for listening, and thank you for making that point. And that is the On Poly podcast for this Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. Yes, the 38th anniversary of the realities of May 2nd. And now everyone knows what that means. Please remember, check out our newsletters. You can subscribe at tvo.org/newsletters. This week, JMM and I riff on some more about electricity generation in this province and whether we truly could do more with less expensive wind options rather than build new, much more expensive nukes.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Our managing editor is Shahir Tajvidi.
Production support from Daniel Kitts and Jonathan Hallowell. Until next Tuesday, everybody, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone. Before you go, we've got a message here from our friends at The Thread with Nam Kiwanuka. What happens when you share personal information online? Who has access to it? What happens if your private digital data is stolen or misused? As our world becomes increasingly online, serious concerns have arisen across Ontario about who has access to our personal information and how we can better protect it. This month, Nam Kiwanuka and the Thread team dug into the world of digital privacy and security. They spoke with victims of cybercrime, from those swindled online to those caught up in a massive hacking attempt. They also met with the head of the RCMP's National Cybercrime Coordination Center, an OPP detective inspector, and spoke with cyber expert Ritesh Kotak about the changing face of cybersecurity and solutions to keep yourself safer online. You can watch this month's episode now on the Thread's YouTube page and on TVO.org.